You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Jane Healy.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories, the podcast where we bring you the story behind the stories and the storyteller. Author interviews, writing advice, book reviews, all sorts of great stuff. If you are a book lover, Author Stories is the place for you. We have more than 550 author interviews in our archives at HankGarner.com. Please go over there and check it out. Also, check out our YouTube channel, where we also have all of the episodes archived there. If you don't find an author interview that you're looking for on the website, click on the Archives tab. There's a long list of them where you can click and download and listen right there. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors that make the show possible. The Locus, books 1 to 3 by Ralph Kern. The complete Locus series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers must do what it takes to survive. The three books, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Atlantica arrives in a strange new world, unable to locate land and with no way to contact home. They must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locus. The Locus box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science book. Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris, acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today from Ralph Kern. The Locus. The Renegade Star Series, books 1 through 3 from J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it out. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900-plus pages, 300-plus five-star reviews. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns this series takes, or the secrets that get revealed. The Renegade Star series, get the entire box set on Amazon, or audiobook from audible.com. There's links to it in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Jane Healy on the show with me today. Jane, fantastic new book called The Beantown Girls, and it's a book I'm sure that you're going to love. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Let's see, when I was in third grade, I wrote a story called Fat Fireman for the little school newspaper. My grandfather was a firefighter, and it was about firemen that ate too many donuts and couldn't slide down the fire pole in emergencies. And I had that published. That was my first publishing experience. And honestly, I've been hooked ever since. I've always wanted to do this.
Oh my gosh, that is fantastic. So, So when did you write that story?
When I was in third grade.
I love it. Where was it published?
Yeah, just in my little, my school, the Dallin School Elementary newspaper.
Yeah. That is fantastic. I love that so much. So was there a teacher or some administrator or something that you kind of recognized this storytelling thing that you had?
Yeah, I think more than one teacher along the way, but that year it was Mrs. Dolliver, my third grade teacher. But yeah, all along I've definitely been encouraged by some great teachers. My AP English teacher in high school, Mr. Trevisani, was one that was, you know, really, really encouraged my writing and for me to continue with my writing, which I have in various capacities, but I didn't start publishing fiction until a couple of years ago.
But we really owe that third grade teacher a debt of gratitude then, don't
oh,
we?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah. That's amazing. Were you a big reader as a kid?
I really was, yeah. And I read everything, but I obviously enjoyed historical fiction. I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder, all those books. But I also loved fantasy, like Madeline L'Engle, A Wrinkle in Time. I still have my like old tattered copy on my shelf. Susan Cooper, The Dark is Rising series, that was another one I just adored. So yeah, I was always a huge reader.
Nice. So fantasy, was there a certain book or a certain genre that when you discovered it, it changed your life?
I think, you know, I mentioned Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time, and, the character, the main character, Meg, is a really smart, precocious girl and, really into academics and learning. And, I just recognize myself in her. That was the first character that I really recognized myself in that character. And I adored that book and I adored the writing and I connected with the story so much that really, you know, that was probably one of the books that I was like, oh, I would love to be able to do this someday.
Right. Right. You said that you only came back to fiction a couple of years ago. What was your life trajectory before, coming back to fiction?
I went to college and grad school, and I thought I was going to go continue in a higher ed and get my PhD, but then I realized the bureaucracy and the sort of time it would take. I didn't want to be in huge student loan debt for the rest of my life, so I ended up in high tech. One thing I tell younger women who are interested in writing fiction, I'm like, well, you can do that always and work on it on the side, like I have been doing for many years. But I said, you know, they need good communicators in high tech as well. And if you're a good writer, there's some great jobs in the tech industry. So I ended up being a product manager in high tech. And then when my girls were born, they're 12 and 15, I started freelance writing. You know, I was staying at home with them and doing a lot of freelance work for newspapers and magazines and sometimes private clients, but always kind of very much on the side, working on different fiction projects or going to fiction workshops or sharing pages with, you know, my writers group. We all met at Boston Magazine as young moms. So yeah, I've always sort of kept one foot in that world, but also pursued other things career-wise.
I love it when people that work in high tech write historical fiction. There's something, we make assumptions about people. So she's a product manager and she works in a high tech
right.
company. She's going to write science fiction.
No, oh, right,
she's,
right.
I love that people have such varied interest and it's so easy to assume, the things that people are passionate about. But the reality is we can be passionate about a whole host of things and be the same person. I think that's one thing that fiction, brings out that we could learn a lot about each other from.
I think that's true. I think, you know, and I loved my time in high tech and learning about new technologies, and I was with a lot of startups, but, you know, I've always, you know, I was a political science major in college. I've always adored history and politics and historical fiction, obviously. And so, yeah, I mean, everyone's got, you know, all their different interests, and it's, yeah, like you said, it's, you can box people in, but people are a lot more complex than that.
You mentioned writing for the magazine. What was the draw there that got you into essay writing and feature writing?
Well, you know, it's funny when I knew that I wanted to have a like more family friendly career when my daughters were born, and it's fun when you're starting out in freelancing. As I say, I talk at libraries and stuff. You really just take whatever jobs anyone will throw your way. You know, so I started doing like, you know, very tiny, tiny book reviews, and then I started writing, you know, for wedding magazines about flower trends, and you know, and it grew from there to essays and longer pieces, and like I said, I've also I've also done private client work, but I really did enjoy, doing freelance journalism. I worked, did some stuff for Huffington Post and MainStreet.com, a bunch of different online and offline print publications too.
I had a similar experience. I started writing a column for our local newspaper, and then that kind of grew into some other long form essays, and then blogging on some different sites and things like that. And I look back, and even though those early things had nothing to do with what I do now, seemingly, those are places that you kind of learn to hone your skill and kind of get your chops. And how do you feel like writing that sort of stuff has affected you as a fiction writer?
I think any writing you do, makes you a better writer. Even though I was writing nonfiction then, it teaches you about discipline and sticking to a deadline and being able to back up your work with hard research. One thing I take pride in is doing meticulous research, and even though it's fiction, I want to get the facts right, and that, the fact checking and the things like that in journalism teach you to be really meticulous in that way. And also, like I said, writing to deadline, I think is so important. Learning that even when you're not feeling inspired, you still have to sit down and do the work. On the hard days.
Right. Boston factors heavily in your work, and the title of your newest book kind of reflects that. Are you originally from Boston?
I am originally from Boston, and I live about 7 miles north of the city now. In The Beantown Girls, the three main characters are friends from Boston, but the story actually takes place in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. And my first novel was called The Saturday Evening Girls Club, and that was based on a true story of Jewish and Italian immigrant women in Boston's North End at the turn of the 20th century.
That was going to be my next question. The Saturday Evening Girls Club, that began as an article that you wrote for a magazine, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We were talking about different freelance jobs, and my editor at Boston Home called me one day, and she's like, "Oh, do you have any interest in antiquing? Do you collect?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding me? I have toddlers. Like, I don't collect anything that can break." So no. And she was like, "Well, I really need you to do this, bi-monthly column on antiquing." So I was like, "Okay, here we go. That's fine."
And, makes perfect and then, sense.
I'm sorry?
I said, "Yeah, that makes perfect sense with toddlers." Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, nothing that can break. Everything above, got to keep it on the high shelf. And so, I wrote about New England area antiques, and my third column was on Saturday Evening Girl Pottery, which is also called Paul Revere Pottery, because this group of women had this pottery that, even though they never really did well financially at the time, it has become highly collectible. Like, people just adore it. It's an example of the arts and crafts movement of the early 20th century, and people just love it.
That's fantastic. We're actually recording this the Tuesday after the Super Bowl. I would imagine where you live is kind of ridiculous right now.
Oh, yes. Ridiculous. Yes. And I met my husband, and he works downtown Boston last night, and all the buildings are still lit up in red, white, and blue, and the parade is going through downtown today, and last week it was -1, and this week it's 57 degrees here, so the city is just packed with fans partying and drinking, like, first thing in the morning today, so people are pretty fired up still.
That's so funny. Mm-hmm. Even though your new book, The Beantown Girls, doesn't take place in Boston, the characters are Bostonians, and that flavor of that they bring to the story is definitely Boston. What do you think it is that is uniquely Boston that separates it and its people from everyone else?
I think that, we're pretty proud of our culture around here and our history, and obviously our sports teams, as evidenced by this week. I think that, there, when the girls go overseas, you know, people, they meet other soldiers from Boston, and there's that immediate connection. I think that, we're pretty, proud of our roots. And I, you know, and I've even noticed in the Saturday Evening Girls Club, and now with the Beantown Girls, like, the people of this area are just so pumped about these books because they celebrate our history, and it's been really wonderful. You know, the response has been really wonderful from people around here.
What was it about the Saturday Evening Girls Club that really made that story come alive to you? And you wrote the feature piece for it that eventually, became a novel. How did that kind of unfold for you?
Well, you know, I finished, I wrote the article and I was really interested in writing more about these women. I wasn't sure what that meant. I didn't know if that was going to be like a nonfiction long form article or if that was going to be a novel, but I finished the article and I asked myself, like, why hadn't I heard of this club before? Why? I mean, I'm born and bred in Boston. I'd never heard of these women before. And I was bothered by that because they were kind of extraordinary for their time. It was the early 1900s, and they formed this club, cross-cultural, you know, Jewish and Italian immigrant women. And Helen Starrow, one of the founders of the club, she was a big philanthropist in Boston. We have Starrow Drive here in town that's based, named after her family. Edith Gruyere, the local librarian, formed this club for these women to really give them an informal higher education and mentor them and help them, you know, help them realize their own versions of the American dream. And, you know, this was early, you know, 1908, so there wasn't a lot for young women at that time who were intellectually curious or ambitious or wanted to rise above their station in life. And this club provided that in a really unique way that that I had, you know, like people still ask me, like, well, certainly there was clubs like this around the country. And I said, no, that there wasn't. And that's what made it so unique. And that was what intrigued me about the story.
So it's really a story, a true story of this club, this group of people that really kind of cut across people at different stations in life, people different I want to say careers, but that's probably not different places in and it was these people helping one another. What a fascinating concept. Why does it sound so foreign, you know? But it's such
right.
a fascinating thing for 100 years ago.
Yeah, for 100 years. I mean, you know, in these neighborhoods, like, you know, Italians kept it with Italians and Jewish families kept with Jewish families. But because these women were younger and most of them were born in this country or came over as babies, they were able to cross those cultural divides. And then there's the socioeconomic aspect where Helen Starrow was an incredibly wealthy woman but took interest in these young immigrant women who were poor at a time when a lot of her friends in the upper classes were nativists. They were anti-Semitic and they were anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant. But she was very progressive for her time and really changed these girls' lives. I mean, in the book, I talk about how one of them received a scholarship from Helen Starrow to go to college, which is pretty rare back then. But she provided college scholarships for a number of those women, those real women.
Were you surprised that their story had not been properly told?
I was really surprised and a little bit bothered. You know, like, they were kind of extraordinary. I can't believe that that their story hasn't been given it more attention in history. But that, I think, sometimes happens, and that's kind of how I felt the same way when I came across the story of the Clubmobile girls in World War II. I was bothered that they haven't been recognized for the real heroes that they were.
Right. When you find a story like that and it's so powerful and so significant, what are the challenges in writing a fictional story about these real people and real heroes, if you will, where you want to tell an engaging story and you also want to be really true to honor, what these people have done?
I think that's a great question. I think that's the balance. Like, you have to strike the right balance between what is historically accurate and authentic to the time and the place and the people, but also create a fictional narrative that will entertain and inspire and delight readers. And striking that balance is hard. And I think that, you know, every scene I'm, you know, scene by scene, and when I write something all along the way, I'm constantly asking myself, like, is this historically accurate? If it didn't happen, could it have happened? Is it, you know, organic to the time and the place, and does it feel authentic? Those are the biggest questions that I'm constantly thinking about as I write.
And I really envy historical fiction writers and ones like you that really pull it off so well and make it feel so authentic. To me, it seems like one of the hardest things would be when you're working on these characters' emotional choices and the interpersonal interactions, to be careful not to set things in motion that would change history. Is that something that you ever think about when maybe dealing with conflict with characters or introducing people to situations and other people that might not have really happened?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You don't want to think about, you want to make sure you would never do something that would change history in any way. And also you want to make sure that the characters behave, behavior and the way they speak and it all feels like authentic to the time and place and doesn't feel like, you know, that I like even with the dialogue, you don't want it to sound like, you know, people talking in 2018 when it's taking place in 1944. And sometimes those are just like very small nuanced things, but it's important to get it right or it throws the reader out of the story because they're like, wait, that doesn't sound right. You know? So, I'm constantly thinking about that kind of thing.
The Saturday Evening Girls Club was picked up by Lake Union, I believe it was, and published last year. What was the path like to get to that point?
That path was really long and winding, as I say in my talk.
As most of us are. Yeah.
Yeah, I think most authors have their own long and winding stories. I tried to get it published about 6 years ago now, and I did. I went through the whole process. I queried a number of agents over 50. I had a lot of strong responses, a lot of requests for full manuscripts. I felt like momentum was on my side. I thought I was going to get signed, and I ultimately did not get signed with an agent then. And then fast forward to 2 years ago, and I felt like the market was better for immigrant stories, American historical fiction. I just feel like that, you know, with successive books like Orphan Train and Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, I felt like, you know what, I'm going to try to get this manuscript out there one more time. And I think publishing is persistence, and it's a little bit of luck and a little bit of timing. And so this time it happened for me, but it took, you know, like I had put it on the shelf and almost given up on it. But I'm really glad that I didn't.
Absolutely. So after that book came out and was well received, when did the idea for Beantown Girls, the Beantown Girls, come to you? And what was the kernel that brought this story to you and as it came to life?
Great question. So
it was like 9 questions, so I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'll try to answer all of them. And so I was, you know, trying to sort of start thinking about what I wanted to write next and, you know, what I wanted to pitch to Lake Union for my next project. I wanted to write a big story. I wanted to write World War II because that era has always kind of fascinated me. My grandfather was a World War II vet. And I was kind of searching around, doing a little research here and there. I came across this picture, I think it was on Pinterest, of these 4 women in Europe standing in a field, kind of laughing with each other. They were wearing these uniforms I didn't quite recognize, and it said, you know, the caption was, you know, Red Cross Club Mobile Girls in such and such England, 1944. And my first question was, who were the Club Mobile Girls? Like, what's a Club Mobile? And it turns out it was Red Cross clubs on wheels, and basically converted trucks, the equivalent of modern day food trucks, actually, that, you know, and these women would drive around and drive to the front lines of the war, serving coffee and donuts and playing music and trying to boost troop morale, because, you know, morale was one of the biggest problems in the military during World War II. And so the more digging I did, the more the question started coming up, as it did with the Saturday Evening Girls, well, how come I haven't heard about these women? I just can't even believe that all of the amazing things they did, and I just have never heard about them before. So I that once again was like sort of the string that I had to pull to start the research and jump into this project.
It's such a common thread here that there's these fantastic women doing amazing things, and they just get glossed over in the in the telling of history. And that's one thing that I love about this. I don't know if resurgence is the right word, but there we do seem to have a lot of really great historical fiction coming out now, especially around this time period. And I think, you know, that we are in trouble, in danger of losing the narrative around some of these stories, because the farther we get away from a historical event, and, you know, most of the veterans that served during that time and all the people that supported them, are leaving us. And the farther we get away from that, the more a historical event gets reduced to bullet points. This happened at this battle. This happened at the signing of this treaty, and we lose the human story around it. And that's what I love about this, is we're rediscovering all of these fantastic stories of people that did amazing things. Women that went to the front lines of battle to bring a food truck just to make people happy. That's one of the best war stories ever.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought so too. Thank you very much. And I it's funny, when I started doing the research, I'm at Schlesinger Library at Harvard University, which is really close to me. They have just amazing archive material of American women's history. And so I started looking, and I was like, oh, do you have anything on these women? And they actually had 13 boxes of archived material, of diaries and letters and pictures and ration cards and, you know, training manuals. And as I started reading and going through the material, it was clear to me from these, first of all, some of these women were amazing writers, beautiful writers, and it was clear to me that they knew that they were witnessing history. They were very aware of that, and they were trying to capture it, whether it was for their families, for themselves, but they just wrote these beautiful detailed letters and these very detailed diaries, and it made it so much fun. First of all, the research was really it's so fantastic, but also it really drove the narrative for me. I mean, it would really, I won't say the story wrote itself, because it certainly did not. It was very hard, but the research was so much more than I had with the Saturday Evening Girls, because it was in the 1940s, not 1908. You know, there was just so much more material available to me.
It's one thing to tell a story, kind of a faceless story about these women and the Club Mobile, that whole kind of, happening that happened there. But it's an entirely different thing to put a face, on it, and a name. Tell me about Fiona Denning, and, how did she come to you in this story?
I'd read about all these women and all their different personalities, the real women, the real Red Cross Club Mobile girls. And, I wanted the three main characters to reflect some of the qualities and backgrounds of, and also actually some of their supporting characters as well, of the real women. So Fiona is kind of a composite of some of the different women I read about. One of them that I read about, Elizabeth Richardson, comes to mind when I think of, Fiona and sort of developing her as a character. Liz Richardson was really well liked. She was a natural leader and very intelligent, and really took to the job. You know, she really it was hesitant at first when she went over there, but really it really flourished as time went on and came into her own. And so I think Fiona is probably most like Elizabeth Richardson in terms of the real Club Mobile girls, in that she was a leader. She loved the job more than she ever thought she would, and really found herself as time went on.
What did you learn in this book, in the writing of it, that really surprised you and maybe made you think differently about the time, the climate, how the war affected more than just the soldiers on the front line? Were there things in the story that really just made you sit back and kind of wow at what happened?
Yes, so many things. That there were even women allowed on the front lines. These women had more access than war correspondents and actually most soldiers. They could go in and out of the front lines. The military gave them a lot of freedom. And actually, that brings to mind another point. I didn't realize how closely aligned the military and the Red Cross were, how much they worked really hand in hand on supporting the troops, and how much the Red Cross was involved in the war efforts, you know, not only on the home front, but on the front lines. That was really interesting to me as well. Another point that I wanted to make is, one of the things that kept coming up in these letters and diaries I was reading is a lot of these women talked about living in what they called the bubble of war with these soldiers. And these soldiers and these women all realized that, you know, times were really hard. War was hard. It could be heartbreaking and demoralizing, but they really tried to live for the moments of joy and reprieve and comfort. And whether that was, you know, jitterbugging in a field in the middle of the night or, you know, having some coffee and cigarettes around a fire, they really tried to embrace those brief moments of happiness, and they didn't take them for granted. And I think that's what helped them survive ultimately.
I love that. Jane, how has your writing process changed after the first novel and then writing The Beantown Girls? The time between the first novel and this one is a lot shorter than the time you had before publishing the first one. How has the way you do the work of writing changed?
This one, you know, it was a whole different experience because I had to write a book on deadline. And like I said, I think my freelance writing experience working on deadlines certainly prepared me, but it's nothing like writing a novel on deadlines. that was a new challenge for me. But I really had to be very disciplined. And some people I know, you're writing, people talk about plotters versus pantsers and outlining versus not outlining. I was really thorough, not only in my research, but in my outlining, so that I had a roadmap. Now that doesn't mean the story didn't change sometimes or evolve a little bit, but I like to have a roadmap for where I'm going, you know, beginning, middle, end. And so I was really, I just had to work really hard to stay disciplined. And like I said, you know, on those days that you feel like the words aren't coming, you still got to sit down and try to crank out as much as you can. And I just planned it out like that, you know, chapter by, you know, how many chapters a week I needed to get done. And if I was behind, I'd work all weekend on it to make sure that I hit the number of chapters I needed for the following week. And you know, just got the work done. But it was, you know, when I signed that contract, my agent was like, "Do you need another month or two?" Because I wrote it in about 7 months. And I'm like, "No, I'll be fine." And then afterwards, I panicked. I'm like, "Why didn't I ask for another month or two? What is wrong with me?" But it worked out okay in the end.
It's so funny. When you're writing a book like this, and you have real people and real events that you're working the story around. I would presume that, like you said, that you were a pretty serious outliner. How much research did you do before the writing? And how much did you ever get to a point in the writing where you just have to make a note in the manuscript? Like I've got to do some more research about this and come back to it. Did you ever come to places like that where you're like, "I just don't know enough here to fully write this scene"?
I did most of my research before it. Before I submitted the proposal, the synopsis, I had already done a bulk of the research. Then I did even more before I started writing it when I was on deadline. And I felt, you know, in the outline, I had all the basic historical framework and research that I needed. But sometimes when I was writing, it's more like the little details that, you know, as I was writing, I'd end up going on down a rat hole about, you know, women's dress fashions, because I wanted to, like, have some, like, very specific details about certain dresses that they were wearing on their day, their one day off of the, you know, month or whatever. You know, there were different things like that. And geography was another one, geography and street names. Like, I wanted to make sure, you know, they're in London for a time. I wanted to make sure I got all of the geography right for that, because people, that matters to people. Historical fiction readers, you know, they're sticklers, and they'll call you on it. If you get something
yes.
wrong, you will hear about it. So, yeah,
yes, you will.
Those details, I you know, that's the type of stuff as I was writing that I'd have to kind of take pause and be like, okay, I have to make sure I have these little details right, or else the fact checkers and copy editors are going to come back at me anyway. So let's get it right now, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Jane, I absolutely love what you're doing. The Beantown Girls is fantastic. I think, that this book, appeals to, I think a very broad audience, because there's something there for everybody. What do you hope, when people finish the book and they close the back cover, what do you hope that they're left with?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words too. I mean, I'm thrilled that you loved it. And, you know, I think that there's a couple of things I want people to take away. One is, having an appreciation of these women in history and what they did for our country and what they went through. And also, though, this is a story, I think, about friendship and love and changing when, you know, changing your mind. When you change your mind, you can change your life. Like, these women were home in Boston feeling a little bit left out of the war efforts and wanting to do something to contribute when they were seeing their brothers and classmates and friends all go off to war. And they took this risk and this chance, and it was terrifying, but it also changed the trajectory of their lives in really amazing ways.
And that it did. And the rest of us, too. You know, you can't separate the contributions of the Clubmobile girls from the history that we all enjoy now. And I just love finding out about some new group of people that I had no idea about, but that connect us all in some strange way. So I love that you wrote the book. I'm glad that you discovered the story to tell. Jane, if people are just learning about you and want to, you know, find out more about what you do and, you know, get into your back catalog and follow along, is there a place where they can find you online?
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you again for all your kind words. I really, really appreciate it. They can find me at janehealey.com. My last name is H-E-A-L-E-Y. And I am on Twitter and Instagram at Healy Jane, and on Facebook, Jane Healy Books.
Great. We'll put links to it, all of the places where they can connect with you, in the show notes. Jane, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Hank. This has been awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Find all the archives at hankgarner.com. Now, stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's stone manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!"
cried Agatha, appearing from the wood. She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond. And in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.